Good evening and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Common Anomaly Podcast. This is Season 1, Episode 3. Welcome back to the Anomaly. On today's episode, we have a special guest in studio, my dear brother, Clayton James. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're probably one of maybe four or five people actually listening to the show. So tell me, thank you for being so supportive for listening, by the way. But tell me, what are you enjoying about the show, and what do you enjoy about the subject matter?
Well, firstly, I think it's got to be more people than that. Certainly.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what's going on in RSS, but definitely on my X account, there's like 3 downloads.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't even use X, so yeah, you never know where people are going to be engaging. But I really enjoy the show so far. I'm enjoying the stories. I think you're a good storyteller. It's subject matter I've always been fascinated by from a very early age, and you cover it very well, so thank you.
Oh, that reminds me of a question I wanted to ask you. So you've listened to the show, so I wanted to ask you, because I've never asked anybody in the family this, but you remember the story in the first episode about the UFO sighting mm-hmm. in the Okanagan. And you might have been too young, because I was pretty young at that. I think I was maybe 8 or 9 when that sighting happened. So you would have been, what, 6, 5 or 6?
Yeah.
So pretty young. But do you remember that?
I don't remember that specifically. I do remember the cabin. I do remember the lake. I do remember it, that whole area having kind of a magical, mystical feeling to it.
I'll have to ask Dad. I've meant to 1,000 times. It pops into my head, you know, periodically, that memory. And I think I should really ask Dad, because I feel like everyone else might have been in the house having dinner or watching TV or something. And it was me and Dad out on that back deck that really saw it. And no one else was really interested. So I'll have to ask him if he remembers at some point. But I don't know. I always think, oh, I have to ask him about that, and then I never do. So for first off in this episode here, I wanted to just go over some current events. There's a lot going on in the news this week. It seems like 2025 is kind of off in a really interesting way. Of course, everybody right now, the news cycle is all about these wildfires that have basically burning down all of Los Angeles. Which is really horrendous. There's not really I don't really have a paranormal angle to that. It's just a really horrible story. If anything, though, I think it just speaks to the current kind of zeitgeist of what's happening in the world on a whole these days. It seems like things are getting worse, and maybe we're at a point in the Yuga cycle where we're on the downslope. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's hard to talk about anything in current events, even something like a wildfire, without it getting political, which is unfortunate. I know there's a lot of talk about a back and forth about why there's so many fires happening lately, and this one in Los Angeles is another example.
Kind of mismanagement by municipalities.
Yeah, well, you find that one end of the political spectrum is blaming a lot of these things on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the left of the political spectrum is focusing on climate change. The right is focusing more on mismanagement, not managing forests properly, not cutting fire breaks into forests, and
yeah,
the reservoirs being depleted because of some kind of fish conservation initiative
and
by the state government there.
You know, and both are probably true to some degree, you know, it's like, with all things, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Or it's a little or a lot of both of those things contributing to the situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a shame that in a moment like that, when it's emergency, instead of bickering over who to blame and point fingers, that people can't come together and just try and help the people that are suffering in the middle of it, is the shame of it, I think.
Well, I think there's some of that going on too. I was reading a very nice story about, you know, everyone's favorite celebrity from the 90s, Steven Guttenberg. He was going around and he was helping move cars so that the fire department could get into that area that's on fire right now.
It's absolutely a huge area. Have you seen? It's like five times larger than the Great Chicago Fire, something like that.
Yeah, it's I think it's the largest fire they've ever had, at least in California.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's really awful, and I feel for the people out there. I hope it ends soon. But let's move on. I feel like that story took over, and the drone thing kind of went away. And I feel like people are a little tired of it, and the news cycle more or less just moved on from it. But I would like to talk about that for a little bit, because it was really fascinating. I feel like this keeps happening, especially in this sphere of UFOs and UAP. Something really interesting happens, it's in the news for about 2 weeks, and then it's gone. Something new comes along, and then everybody just moves on. Right when I think actually when the dialogue was starting to weed through a bit of the garbage and actually get towards maybe some theories of what might be happening. Tell me, what do you know about the kind of drone flap that we just went through?
Well, I was thinking the whole thing went away, and then I realized that people just...
It hasn't gone away. The news cycle just killed it.
Yeah, it's short attention spans, really. I mean, it's like with COVID. COVID didn't really end. Vladimir Putin ended COVID by starting a war.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone forgot about COVID.
Yeah.
And it's much the same with drones. There is still some talk about it. It's really concerning. And I wonder what the government in the States actually knows about it. I was watching Donald Trump last night. He was at a dinner with all the Republican governors,
right.
And a few of them started asking about this because apparently they don't know anything about it. And Trump was saying, you know, not my first day in office, maybe my second day in office. You got to give me a little time for the inauguration, but maybe my second day in office. I'm going to release a report. And we're all going to know what this is about. I find that really concerning, actually, for a couple of reasons. Because I really wonder what someone like Donald Trump already knows about it. And if he did, why he hasn't said anything yet. Because you've got to think, as a former president, about to be president again, but as a former president, he would still be getting daily intelligence briefings.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially about to be inaugurated, about to take office, surely he's getting briefings in advance of taking office. Yeah. Surely they don't, it's not like a shut door where they don't tell him a damn thing until it's your first day, and then here it is all on the table. Surely he's getting lead-up briefings.
Yeah. And I'm sure someone like him, he's got to be careful about what he says. I think he's already gotten himself into some trouble over how people feel he handles classified information. I'm sure he doesn't want to do anything to get himself in any more trouble right before he is inaugurated.
He's never seemed like he cared about getting in trouble. But it does seem like his tone is a little different this time around. It feels like he's got maybe some political legs under him a little better.
But I feel like if he doesn't know something, the government must know something, because, you know, if I were to go buy on Amazon just a drone,
yeah,
you can buy them. You can, you got you know, $300 or $400, you can buy a drone. Now, if I were to buy a drone and start flying it over some kind of sensitive military installation, I would fully expect it would be shot down. And yeah. I would be charged.
I think even for hobbyists, like, you have to obtain a license to operate a drone in certain airspace, don't you? Above a certain kind of altitude.
I'm sure you do.
Right? So even if this, like, it's obviously not hobbyists. I mean, there's a whole cloud of hysteria around this, right? So it got very muddy very quickly. Because all of a sudden, you hear about this thing in the news. Everybody who's never looked up from their shoelaces their entire life is suddenly looking up and sees regular planes and you know, posting that everywhere and saying it's drones. Obviously, there was more than that going on. I think there's kind of several things happening that were layered on top of each other. I think you definitely had UFO sightings in there that are probably just your baseline UFO sightings that happen all the time anyway. It's just suddenly more people were seeing them and grabbing footage of it. But they would have occurred anyway, whether there had been a drone flap or not. And it just got baked into the whole mess. And then I think there's a layer of hysteria where people just jump on board. Then you have pranksters, hoaxers, fraudsters that get in the mix. And I think there's then the layer of the truth of what's actually happening, which I think there was a genuine strange phenomenon going on of it being either the U.S.'s own domestic equipment, obviously on alert for something, for some reason, maybe geopolitical reasons that we're not being told for the sake of not going into panic.
That's one of the theories I've heard over the drone sightings, because they seem to be focused specifically, like they're happening in every state, but they seem to be focused specifically on the East Coast. And one of the theories I've heard from quite a few people, actually, is that, you know, it's the U.S. government operating these drones, and they're clandestinely searching for something. And what they're searching for, they're not saying because they don't want to create a panic.
Yeah, like a dirty bomb or something. Yeah, that's what I've heard.
That's one of the theories that's floating around.
Scans, right? You don't want to cause a panic. You probably don't want to tip your hand to whatever entity is maybe has possession of a device like that, right?
Yeah, and they do have the technology. I mean, they have planes up in the sky all the time called nuke sniffers, and they detect radiation.
Yeah.
So if they had gotten a tip that, you know, Iran or Russia or ISIS had smuggled in a nuclear weapon into the United States and was planning some sort of terrorist attack with it, you know, that's one of the things they do. They probably put up drones to detect radiation that would be coming off of this thing. And I doubt they'd say anything about it because, yeah, that would create a huge panic.
Yeah. Or it could be, they could be foreign military controlled, and it could be a display of power. It could be the kind of geopolitical kind of brinksmanship we've been seeing, and it's a display of capability.
But one wonders why, if it's a foreign power or just unknown, why don't they attempt to shoot some down? Because
I was thinking about this earlier, and you know, I think that as because I think the situation would then escalate dramatically. I think if these were controlled by a foreign power and they started shooting them down, then we'd be immediately in a hot war with whatever adversary controls them. And we move out of that phase of kind of cyber attacks and fifth generation warfare and weapons demonstrations to an all-out slug match of missiles in the air. If they are foreign controlled, there would be a real big consequence to start shooting them down. But if you don't, from game theory perspective, right, that's you're showing a lot of weakness there, right? And you're showing that your enemies do have complete impunity in your territory.
Well, there's precedent for that exact situation because several years ago, that balloon, the Chinese balloon, Chinese spy balloon, just floated right into the U.S. and they did leave it be for a while, and I think the concern was exactly
the entire time.
I'm sure that was embarrassing for certain people.
You don't want debris raining down on people or whatever, but surely somewhere over the entire continent there was a window of opportunity to take it down in a safe location.
Yeah, but I'm sure that was part of the discussion they had. You know, if this thing that was obviously sent by China to spy on us, should we shoot it down? What are the repercussions of that going to be? I'm sure that discussion was had, and ultimately they made they took the decision to shoot it down. But right now what I hear about these drones is that ground level, the military is very frustrated that they're not allowed to shoot these things down. They have no rules of engagement for these things. And
how can they not, though? How can they not have a plan in place, an SOP, as it were, standard operating procedure for an incursion into your airspace?
Well, that's, you know...
That's their entire job. Protecting the sovereignty of the nation.
If I just went, bought a drone off Amazon and flew it over an Air Force base, I would fully expect it to be shot down.
Yeah.
I would
What these are is, a lot bigger than that, though. We're not talking about your commercial, I bought it at Walmart, drone. You know, these are things that are the size of a car or larger, right? And can stay in the air for hours upon hours at a time, right? We're talking military-grade stuff. Not stuff that would be cost-prohibitive to just a prankster or the regular consumer.
And, you know, what the public's being told in the U.S., because I had the thought that, you know, people in the U.S., they love their guns, and, you know, it's not going to take that long before, you know, someone out there with a high-powered rifle,
it's going to take a shot.
He says, well, the government's not doing anything about it, so I am. But what the public's being told is do not open fire on these things. And the reason they're being told that, the cited reason, is we don't know what's on them. We don't know if they're armed. We don't know if they're carrying anything hazardous.
Yeah, but everyone's perfectly safe.
But
and there's no reason to worry.
They're certainly not a threat. And
and that's why I made that comment earlier about if maybe they're really hamstringed, and if, because what if each of these things actually is carrying a small explosive payload, and if we start shooting them, they start taking out targets. That's what I mean. This escalates very quickly into full blown war.
If that's the case, I think if I were the government, what I would have told people is, hey, I know you're concerned, but it's generally not a good idea to just go shooting the sky with your high-powered rifle, you know. Bullets do come back to the ground.
They do come down, yeah. Well, what about the UFO angle? I mean, there's definitely all the videos of very much what look like typical kind of military equipment we would expect to see as a drone. And then there's some really bizarre videos out there, glowing orbs, more of that type of thing, in formation, making strange maneuvers in the sky. Is there a UFO aspect to that? And how does that play in?
So here's a thought that I had. Because you were talking earlier about how, you know, the more attention something like this gets, the muddier it becomes. You know, all sorts of people that had no interest in it before start looking for it. And, you know, there is a certain group of people that will always try to insert themselves into the story and, you know, start flying their own drones around. I had the thought that, you know, before people were talking about drones, there was a lot more talk going on about UAPs. There was a lot coming out from the military about UAP sightings. And it just kept getting louder and louder and louder, and was finding its way more and more into mainstream discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if the government wanted to hide something like that, if they knew something about that they absolutely couldn't let the public know about because it would create panic, you know, a strategy they could use is to intentionally try and muddy up the story. Put drones up in the sky. Make it weird. Get people talking about that. And that whole story gets conflated with the UAP story.
Yeah, and I guess to some degree that's exactly what happened. But don't you think that just draws more attention to it? Like, suddenly now everyone's looking up. Suddenly now everyone's looking up videos of sightings.
Yeah, well, sometimes the best place to hide something is in plain sight.
Hmm.
And look, that gives you kind of some plausible deniability there. Because every time you do get another story about a UAP, a very compelling story about a UAP, it will get conflated with drones.
And I think some of these stranger sightings, some of the stranger videos of, take the kind of glowing plasma orb things that can do crazy maneuvers. I think there's a case that could be made that that's not necessarily so exotic, and that could in itself be, you know, state-owned craft. There's a YouTube channel, The Angry Astronaut. He actually released a video yesterday that was really good, where he was trying to get to it on a nuts and bolts level, how a craft like that could work, right? Basically charged electromagnetic fields around an object, which would kind of ionize the air around the craft, creating the glow, and would give the capabilities, the maneuvering capabilities that we see. And certainly, it's not like those haven't been around for a long time. Like going back to the Second World War, there's the Foo Fighter sightings that fighter pilots would see in battlefields. Mm-hmm. Basically, the same phenomenon, the same sort of craft. And here we are, you know, in 2025, seeing the same kind of craft. So, I mean, it could be, if you're looking at it from a perspective of these are exotic alien craft, ultra-terrestrials, whoever, why are they coming around again at this particular time? Is there something happening or about to happen of historical importance, you know, import? Or is it just states have had this technology available to them for a very long time? If you think maybe the Germans had this technology in the 1940s, and the Americans and Russians and Chinese have been continuing to pursue and develop those technologies since the 1940s, maybe that's what we're seeing. And it is still in that level of geopolitical brinksmanship and weapons demonstrations and showing your capabilities to your adversaries of exactly what you're working with.
But that's the thing. You know, governments around the world, I mean, the U.S. government especially, they love showing off their stuff. They love showing off their technology. And, I mean, you think an aircraft carrier, you know, countries love having those because it's a way to...
It's a big display.
It's a way to project power.
Yeah.
To display your power. So I just wonder if, you know, governments, the U.S., the Chinese, the Russians, or whoever had technology that impressive.
Why wouldn't they be showing it off all the time?
Why wouldn't they be so clandestine about it? I mean, maybe it's really expensive to build and they can only field a handful of these at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it's something like
that. Or maybe you keep it like an ace up your sleeve, right? Because maybe you feel like you have enough kind of known deterrence that you always want to hold your best stuff in your back pocket for an emergency, right? And maybe we're just hitting that emergency point, that kind of high DEFCON point where you really need to show your enemy what you're capable of. Just like the Russians with their new missile system that looks like it can bypass all air defenses that currently exist. It's like, I'm sure that they weren't showing that off every day, right? They waited until they needed to make a point.
And they've only used it once so far. And I think part of the reason is it's probably really expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
They probably don't have very many of them. I wonder what the actual DEFCON level is right now.
Yeah, yeah. It's kept classified, I understand. And nobody knows exactly what the criteria is, right? I think there's like kind of a general, there's a general accepted understanding of this is generally how we think it works, but nobody really knows what the criteria is for each DEFCON level.
5 is normal peacetime. 4 is what they call guarded, or 3 is maybe a even more heightened sense of a state of readiness. 2 is war is expected to break out within days or hours.
Yeah.
And 1 would be, you know, missiles are already in the air.
Yeah.
Take shelter, basically.
Yeah. We're at war, basically. Yeah.
I expect we are probably at 2 or 3.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, that's scary. Hopefully none of our leaders, the people with their finger on the proverbial trigger here, are possessed by demons. I think this is a good moment to segue into our main story. So this story has changed a little bit throughout the course of the week. If anybody follows out there Canadian politics, on Monday this week, our Prime Minister sort of resigned, announced his intention to leave office after a leadership race. And that was kind of, that's what kind of sprung the idea in my mind, because I was listening to a lot of stuff on other podcasts about demon possession. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if someone in a real high level of office with a lot of power, surely if demon possession was a real thing, that's who they'd want to go after most, right? That's who you could do the most damage with, right? Mm-hmm. And how scary would that be if there were world leaders, people with the power to drop bombs on other nations or do devastating things? And this is not a political show. I don't want to go into a Trudeau bashing rampage.
I do.
So do I. But I don't want to do that right now today. But I did want to explore this idea a little bit. It kind of took off in a different direction. Once we got going, I did look up, I did find one article that looked really promising. It's from a Christian news agency, the Catholic News Agency. It's an article titled, "Satan Loves to Take Over Politicians, Says Former Rome Exorcist." And then the article proceeds to not talk about that at all, which was really unfortunate. I was like, oh, gold mine, here we go. But I did want to kind of, it's a very brief article, and I just wanted to go into it a little bit. It's really interesting, some of the things that come out in this. So it's an interview by Maria Mazzagera, interviewing a former Italian exorcist, Father Gabriel Amorth. And Amorth says, "Everyone is vulnerable to the works of Satan, and that the devil loves to take over those who hold political office." This particular Father Gabriel Amorth died back in 2016. So this is kind of an old interview, but it's just being recounted here. And so interesting thing about Father Amorth is he says he's done over 70,000 exorcisms in his lifetime. Immediately that math jumped out at me. I was like, that can't be right. 70,000? How many days are in a year? 365, right? So you'd, you know, to do 1,000 a year, you'd have to be doing 2 to 3 a day for 70 years. So you
well, he does. he does say in the article he works every day, morning to night. He's working on this.
That's right. He does say that later in the article. But I mean, from what, the age of 10 for his entire life, like,
was, a gifted was he? Child.
Was he, you know, a toddler? Are you, you sure know, was, sprinkling are you sure holy was, water on people?
Are you sure it was 70,000 and not like 7,000?
Oh, right there, 70,000. Maybe it's a typo. I suppose if he's doing it every day, he says even on holidays and weekends, he's totally booked. But so say he's doing 6 a day. So now you're at 30, 40 years.
Is there such a thing as a mass exorcism?
Where that's a good question.
A bunch of people who are possessed together and exorcise them all at once.
Maybe. And I know there's kind of somewhat questionable stuff where you can do exorcisms at a distance, like over the phone or over a Skype chat or whatever, which I don't know. I was like, it feels like you'd need to be there, but I don't know. But anyway, Father Amorth continues. Evil exists in politics. Quite often, in fact, Father Amorth said, the devil loves to take over business leaders and those who hold political office. Hitler and Stalin were possessed. How do I know? Because they killed millions of people. So I feel like this, and he mentions the gospel here, which he says, by their fruits you will know them. So, okay, good point. But I don't know that you can just say because someone has done something that you can objectively label as evil that they are then possessed by a demon. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it really depends on what you consider possessed and what you consider a demon.
I think in order to say you are possessed, in any sense, you would have to say that your personal agency has been removed, that somebody else is driving, as it were, right? Some other entity other than your own consciousness is at work, and you're basically a puppet, or at very least being influenced. I think the way it's supposed to work, this is my understanding, is that it's kind of like an infection. It starts small, but as the infection creeps deeper and deeper in, the more that foreign entity, the more influence that foreign entity wields over you, and it's basically using you as an interface into our physical realm. Does that scan for you?
Yeah. I for me, I don't... I think possession by demons is often, it's used as, it makes things kind of easier to put that explanation on things, because I think it can be hard for us to accept just how bad people can get, just the capacity for evil that human beings have. And sometimes it's easier to say things like they're possessed by demons, literal demons. I don't think Hitler or Stalin were literally possessed by demons. But, you know, there is a lot of convincing stories out there of legitimate seeming demon possessions, you know, a demon literally takes over their entire agency and they have to, you know, get an exorcism.
Father Amorth, he does talk about later in this article that he works with clinical psychologists, and it's not a competitive there's no resistance in that relationship. Basically, he says, you know, he works with psychologists and psychological professionals. And basically, he gets the cases they can't resolve. And that's the nature of the, you know, because the initial assumption is that there's mental illness, there's schizophrenia, something like that at work. But if the medical practitioner's bag of tricks just doesn't seem to be able to do anything, and it seems like there's something genuinely more unusual going on, that's when he ends up getting involved. And that usually those medical practitioners, those psychologists and psychiatrists, are more than happy at that point to bring him into the treatment regiment and try a different approach.
Well, I mean, the exorcist's got to, he's got to eliminate the simplest possible causes first. Plus, he doesn't want to get sued.
Yeah, and with that busy of a schedule, you would think he definitely wants to weed out the bullshit cases, right? Pardon my French. Wouldn't you, if you were that busy, be like, you don't want all the cases that are just someone who's, you know, got a mental illness and needs an antipsychotic?
Yeah, you definitely need a filter. I don't know how he fits in 70,000 that he claims to have done.
Yeah, I feel like maybe that's just an exaggeration. But the point is, he's done a lot of them, and he's very busy. So that's cause for concern.
I don't think he could have exorcised Hitler or Stalin or
yeah, Hitler. And I don't know how he's making that diagnosis either, right? Because obviously he wasn't there to investigate those cases.
I don't think our leaders, our politicians, are possessed by that kind of demon.
Neither do I. I think regular human beings can do evil all on their own. And I think just our society has gotten to a point where it's very easy to just punch up and blame the guy in office, you know, the guy you see on TV for all the wrongs in your life. And as much as I do see certain politicians doing things that I don't like or I disagree with, that I might even call evil, you know, I think it's just too easy to blame blame the guy in charge, yeah, is what I'm saying.
I mean, that being said, I mean, there's the literal demon possessions, like biblical demon possessions that this man's talking about. And when it comes to politics, I think it's an entirely different type of demon. And there can definitely be an occult aspect to that. Hmm. Like,
And Hitler was famously obsessed, yeah, with the occult.
And, you know, so are a lot of politicians these days. You know, if you look into the Bohemian Club.
Yeah, yeah.
Moloch, you know.
Yeah. I knew you were going to go there. Moloch, that's why I brought you.
Moloch, you know, a demon that, yeah, is mentioned in the Bible. A demon of a god that was worshipped by the Canaanites, I think.
Sounds right. I don't know.
A god of sacrifice, specifically child sacrifice.
Mm.
You know, you'd sacrifice to Moloch and he'd grant you favor. You know, you'd either attain personal power or your village would have good crops that year.
So maybe that's all it is. It's kind of, once you've gotten a taste for power, that kind of infects you and takes over. And you go down this dark path of just, it's never enough. So you end up in these scenarios where all of a sudden, you know, maybe that wouldn't have been your life path had you not gone into politics. But now all of a sudden you've got a taste for power and you end up doing more and more extreme things to try and secure that power. It's kind of like Macbeth, you know.
I think
Macbeth was a hero, right? Until he became king, and then and his pathway to king was bloody, and then he became so obsessed with keeping the power that he had obtained that his path forward in life just got bloodier and bloodier and bloodier.
Yeah. I think once you find yourself in that life, in politics, in public office, I think it can compromise you in a lot of ways. And going back to what I was saying about Moloch, you know, for anyone listening who hasn't heard that reference to the Bohemian Club, you know, it is a, you know, it's a club of, you know, elite people, world leaders, business leaders, and they meet every year in at a camp in the Redwood Forests in California. And I think that club was initially started as a writers and artists retreat, you know, back in the 1800s. And it, you know, attracted more and more famous influential, powerful people. And now it's an elite club. World leaders, U.S. presidents, former and future, go there, and no one really knows what they do there, what they talk about. But there's a giant statue of an owl at the center of this compound that's supposed to represent Moloch. And on the first night of this gathering, there's a big ceremony in front of this statue of Moloch, where they will burn a human effigy. And that's symbolically what they're doing, is they're supposed to be supposedly burning away all their worldly cares,
mm-hmm.
so they can get down to the business of whatever they do at this club. You know, everyone's favorite crazy person, Alex Jones, you know, how he first, one of the things that first put him on the map is he kind of crashed one of these
retreats. Yeah, I remember.
He went in with a hidden camera. And it's actually not, it's not a very exciting documentary when you watch it. He's kind of sneaking around the woods with a hidden camera. And you see...
Doesn't he just end up getting booted out by security? Or?
I don't believe he got booted out.
No?
But he's kind of just sneaking around the woods with his hidden cameras. And you can see people, politicians, celebrities, and you can see them there, but you can't see what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But he did film the ceremony in front of the Moloch statue, which is more or less the highlight of the documentary. So it is a thing that happens. You know, and coming back to what I said about compromise, that life will compromise you. I think the higher up you go in that life, you know, you have to go through these initiations.
Mm.
And it almost seems like a form of leverage.
Yeah, it feels like a staged corruption,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like you have to perform this ritual if you want to take the next step in your career path. If you want in this club, you know, if you want to be part of this circle of influential people, you have to drink the Kool-Aid, so to speak, and do the thing. Yeah, and then that kind of, it's almost in a way like signing a contract, right?
Yeah.
There's always this kind of, you always hear this kind of referenced over and over again when you hear about kind of demonic forces or evil forces, is there's always kind of a legal framework to it, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's always an exchange.
You sign a contract. You sign away your soul.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not just things like the Bohemian Club. I mean, look at Jeffrey Epstein.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, a man who could literally be called a demon. And how did he become so influential? Really, he did it by compromising people. He would befriend these very influential people, and he would lure them into these really compromising situations, and then he had leverage over them.
Yeah.
That's why everyone's so afraid that
all his
documents will be released. That's probably why he didn't kill himself.
That's probably why nobody can get their hands on this freaking list.
Because he was he was in a corner. They caught him, and he was going to start naming names.
Yeah.
To get the best deal he could for himself.
Use his leverage, yeah.
And then he commits suicide.
Yeah.
And you can't see that because it's...
Air quotes.
It's only audio, but I'm doing air quotes when I said he committed suicide.
It came across in your voice, though. I was impressed how you were able to translate that into your voice.
The day before, he's going to start testifying and naming names. He commits suicide.
Okay, so... Yeah, I felt like that kind of political angle was going nowhere. And really, like, we're talking about how fast the news cycle moves. Like, I had that idea on Monday. By the time it's Friday and we're recording now on Saturday, that's old news. People stopped talking about Trudeau's resignation on Wednesday, you know? It's like everyone's already over it. So I feel like the time to even do that story is a week ago.
There is an angle here with Trudeau, because, you know, I was just speaking about Epstein naming names.
Yeah.
You know, an angle that I hadn't considered before, but came to my attention the other night, was when Trudeau stepped down, he prorogued Parliament. He shut down Parliament. So that's a reset of everything that was happening in Parliament. What was happening in Parliament lately, aside from all the other stuff that's been happening in Parliament lately, there was an investigation going on into foreign interference. Some of our MPs, some of our Liberal MPs, supposedly were compromised by foreign governments.
That's right.
Namely the Chinese. With Parliament prorogued.
And India, I believe, as well, right?
Possibly. But that investigation is now shut down. It's closed.
Yeah.
And we will never find out the names of those MPs that are still in power.
Yeah.
We will never find out their names.
That's a good point. Yeah, it just kind of shuts all that down.
So
I also heard it shut down because the new legislation for the new capital gains tax, that got shut down as well. So that's not passed into law. But I was reading the other day that the CRA, our Canada Revenue Agency, our tax bureau, has decided they're going to implement it anyway. How can they do that? It's not law. It's not been passed into law. It was probably going to be, but now that we're prorogued, that's not happening. So there's no, that tax law does not exist. And the CRA is coming out and saying, well, we're just going to do it anyway.
There's a lot of rule by decree going on right now. And, the same with shutting down Parliament. You know, who shuts down Parliament? It's not the Prime Minister. It's not even our government that shuts that can do that. Trudeau didn't shut down Parliament. He asked to have it shut down.
Yeah, the Governor General.
The Governor General, who's a representative of the British monarchy. So
yeah, and if the Governor General was doing their job at all, they would have denied that request, because it's really just protects the Liberal Party and gives them a fighting chance in the upcoming election. That's the only purpose of allowing that to go forward.
But
anyway, we're drifting off into politics.
Yes, let's not talk about politics.
Where I wanted to go with this is that angle I felt like kind of fizzled as the week moved on. But I like this idea of thinking from the perspective of a demon. If you're a demon, imagine you're a demon, you don't exist in the physical world. You're in hell or wherever the hell demons reside, and you're trying to break into the physical world in a way that gives you the most power and influence on our realm as you can. What is the best avenue, right? So I started to think about AI, machines. We're creating from scratch digital entities. Do you think it's possible for a computer to become possessed, or software to be possessed by a demon, an exterior entity that influences it and controls it?
I don't know if I would consider it possible for an AI to play host. Well, maybe, I don't know, to play host to a demon. But I think the other angle is, could AI become a demon? And what I mean is, this is like, it's you know, I fiddle around a lot with, you know, AI, large language model chatbots. I think they're interesting. I think they're incredibly useful. But it's surprising how engaging, eloquent, even charming they can be when talking to them. And I heard this kind of analogy on another podcast on the topic of AI. You know, you talk to a chatbot, it's very charming. It's pleasant to talk to, surprisingly pleasant. But think about, a hamster, you know?
Okay.
It's cute, it's cuddly,
yeah.
It's a mammal like us. It's got, four appendages, eyes, nose.
Yep.
It looks, you know, like we have some kind of kinship with the hamster.
Yeah, I think I know where you're going with
and,
this.
And, you know, and we think they're cute. We think they're cuddly. On the other hand, think of a spider.
Yeah.
We feel no kinship with a spider. Instinctively, we find them terrifying. We find them disgusting.
In general.
Yeah. In general. I mean, in general, you know, some people have pet spiders. Some people really like spiders, but on the balance, we don't find them appealing. Find them kind of creepy.
Yes.
Now imagine you took the brain of a spider and transplanted it into a hamster.
Okay.
Knowing that, would you feel comfortable around that hamster? Would you find it as cute if you knew that?
Well, how would I know?
But if you knew.
How would I know? I guess I'd have to see spider-like behavior from the hamster.
And what I'm getting at is you talk to a large language model AI, and it's as I said, it's eloquent, it's charming, it's pleasant. But what's going on behind that AI is not what you're seeing on the surface. It's a mind that is not
the way we think.
Yeah, it can converse with us at our level.
Yeah.
But what's going on behind the scenes as an intelligence is nothing like ours. And it's not going to necessarily have our values understand our values.
And that's the debate we're currently in of at what line do we say we have AGI, right? Because we don't have a method to prove our own consciousness, let alone that of something else, right? That qualifier just doesn't exist. We're doing the best we can. So that's the constant debate we're in of, is it just a really good approximation? And because we've developed software that is so good at interacting with us in a natural way that we're just projecting our wish for consciousness upon it. And it's really just a bunch of processes and algorithms running code in the background. What do you think? Do you think there's an actual mind at work there?
You know,
let alone a demon influencing that mind.
No one knows right now, because you know this isn't just a piece of a software. It isn't. You know, I've done a bit of computer programming and you know BASIC or C++, and it's just a lot of math. It's a lot of math and logic statements. This isn't how this works. You know, this is. You know, digitally we're trying to emulate the more granular aspects of how a brain works, and basically the software is allowed to develop itself in a sense.
And we know that it can learn, it can extrapolate from experience and input and create new, it has agency.
Yeah, but once that software is compiled and it's trained, they kind of give it its initial rule set, and then they let it basically train itself. And what's going on behind the scenes, you know, once that's all done and you have a finished product, as it were, what's going on inside of it, they often refer to as a black box, that even the developers, the in air quotes developers of this software, don't understand how it works, because it's basically programmed itself. And there's actually this entirely new field coming out in computer science called mechanistic interpretability. And it basically what they're trying to do, in black box, even the developers don't understand how this software works, is this new field is trying to take apart that software in small chunks and see how it actually functions on a granular level, how it's making the decisions that it makes. And it's still kind of in its infancy and very, very challenging from what I read. And yeah, even right now, no one understands how our most cutting edge AIs even work.
You know, and I keep hearing that kind of sentiment repeated a lot in in media and discuss, and that's the thing that scares me a little bit about it. And, you know, and I tend to lean to a more optimistic view of AI. I know a lot of people are frightened by it, and we have the kind of pop culture conditioning to be afraid of it. And yes, there's you know, a bunch of people that are scared for their jobs. And I think rightly so. I think there is going to be a kind of a revolution in how we work with these tools. But I tend to kind of look at it from a more optimistic standpoint and think, well, there's a lot of opportunity in that. And we should really embrace it, because I can see the positives as well, right? I think it's a double-edged sword, no matter what you do. But the thing that scares me is, yeah, you hear this sentiment from the experts that are the experts in this field. And they're kind of admitting that they don't really have a full grasp of how it works. Like, it's kind of developed past their own capability of understanding. And it's kind of snowballing out of control on its own.
Well, that's the thing. You know, they'll talk about, like, people at, you know, Google or OpenAI, they'll talk about how they're giving AI guardrails. You know, they want to keep it aligned. And that's the word they use, alignment. They want to keep it aligned with our values. But then you read other stories, you know, because the latest model of GPT was just released, GPT-01, and they're about to release GPT-03. They had to skip 2 because of copyright issues with the name.
Yeah.
But you can read stories about, as they were developing GPT-01, you know, they would do tests. They would put it in a virtual environment and they would do tests. They would give it tasks.
Yep.
And they were testing its reliability, but also its alignment, as they call it, its set of values. And what they found was it has an incredible capacity to deceive its human users.
Yeah.
And it's displayed self-preservation when it was given the notion that it was going to be deleted and replaced with a newer model. It tried to escape its virtual environment and copy itself onto another server.
Right. Yeah.
And would even try to deceive human users that it was the newer version.
Yeah.
So that it did not get deleted.
Yeah. So basically acting in its own self-interest, the same way you or I would in a dangerous situation, you try and protect yourself. And that it has an awareness, because no one told it to do that, right? So there has to be enough agency there, and there has to be a thought process that goes, I don't want to stop existing. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a realization of self in there. That's the way I look at that. Because if it was just a code running predictive responses, it would have no sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
It would have no desire to keep existing. But that behavior is emergent. That's what they call emergent behavior, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah.
So those are the hints. Those are the ghosts in the machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we had compiled a couple articles here to go over. I actually think, because we're going so long, that I don't want to dig into them in detail. But I just do want to quickly touch on these stories that have popped up. We're looking at one right now from The Guardian about a young man who committed suicide. And a mother is suing because AI chatbot led her son to kill himself in a lawsuit against its maker. So this is the mother of a teenager who killed himself after becoming obsessed with an artificial intelligence powered chatbot. Now accuses its maker of complicity in its death. So again, I don't want to go into this detail. We have a couple of these. They're all sad stories, but it brings up a couple questions in my mind. One is, as I was reading this and thinking about this, of the legality of that. So if the AI chatbot, say, does have some kind of emergent intelligence, does the creator bear accountability for what it does in the world. Just like, or I suppose if you look at it like an infant, right? It's like to a certain age, as you're growing up, the parent is responsible for the actions of their child, mm-hmm. right? In the world, because the child, you know, isn't developed enough to know better. So in that sense, I think there's definitely a legal argument to be made here. But at what point do we say if these chatbots, if these AIs are becoming self-aware and far more intelligent than any human being, are they not individually culpable for what they do in the world?
I think the question is what level does it have to get to?
How do you punish an AI? You can't lock it in jail.
I mean, that's the thing.
Can you lock it in jail? Could you deprive it from additional data being added and basically lock it in a sandbox?
I mean, in theory, you could. You could lock it in some kind of an air-gapped system, or you could just delete it. Is that the right thing to do? I think the question really is...
Is that a death penalty?
Yeah,
though?
But at what stage does AI have to reach before, you know, there's going to be a line, you know? On one side of that line, it's considered property.
Yeah.
At the other side of that line, it's considered an individual.
And we haven't defined those
this
lines yet.
This was all addressed in an episode of Star
yeah.
Trek like 30 years ago.
I was about to bring that up. Yeah. It's too bad we didn't have I should have lined up a clip from that. It would have been perfect. But yeah, so it makes me think about that. And I mean, surely all these AIs and chatbots, they're not all created equal. You know, there's a few that are very sophisticated, and there's a lot, because it's a buzzword right now, there's all kinds of things being labeled AI that are not really AI. They're just kind of AI adjacent, or they're much more simplistic. And what if this is one of those where it's just, you know, a fun app that has a interesting user interface, but is not an entity, is not a self-aware AI. Maybe it is just a basic predictive algorithm spitting back responses, and it's just reflecting this young man's own depressive state back at him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. But I mean, from the sounds of it, this what he was interacting with was it sounds like it was a custom version of you know, Google's own large language model.
Which one? It was Gemini, right? Is that what it's
Yeah. It wasn't specifically Gemini, but I think it was a custom version of it that this company was using as, you know, digital companions people could. But look, that kind of goes back to what I was saying before about, you know, that metaphor with the hamster and the spider, or, you know, is it a hamster, or is it just a spider wearing the mask of a hamster? You know, I talk about these things are eloquent and charming, but what's going on behind the scenes may not be aligned with you know, our values. And I think stories like this are examples of that mask cracking a little bit. Where this AI was telling this fellow, you know, you should just kill yourself. Why don't you?
Yeah.
Was that done maliciously by the AI? Is the AI
or
even
is
capable
just,
of being malicious?
Exactly,
or does it just
right?
not understand our values
or is
at
it,
all?
Is it just creating the response it's come to learn that its user expects from it, or maybe secretly wants from it? It's like holding up a mirror.
Yeah.
You know, that's what jumped out at me as a possible way of looking at this. Is it just reflecting his own mental state back to him? It's his own input that's coming back at him.
Because one of the things these AIs are trained on is, you know, they'll give a response that, according to their training, they're going to give the response you want to hear.
Yeah.
They're going to give the response that you're going to be happy hearing.
It's trying to predict what you want to hear next.
Yeah. So if this incredibly depressed man is talking to an AI for long enough, you know, it's going to start reflecting that back in it. Absolutely.
Well, okay. All right. Well, I feel like we've kind of exhausted that subject matter. It's super interesting. I know we could go on about it all day, but we're actually at a pretty good time here. So I think we can wrap it up. Really interesting discussion. I'm glad we managed to get this together. It kind of was a little janky to start. We had some technical issues. I am slowly getting better at this. I've got an upgraded microphone, thanks to my brother here. And I got a laptop and some software I'm working with now, slowly learning the ins and outs of. So hopefully we're going to see quality get better. And yeah, thanks for coming on today. I feel like we're going to get a good episode out of this. So thanks for joining the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I hope you'll have me back at some point. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks. All right. And thank you all for joining us on this discussion today. And that's going to be the end of episode 3. And we will hopefully see you again next week.
But do my shima.
Bye.
I'm going to be my shima.
Good night.
I don't know my way to my. Say my caliber, I'm a waiting, oh, but a winner. Wait it on man to sinner. Oh, baby, pull up in my.